There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Wednesday, December the 11th.
Stars Play is teaming up with Imagination in Abu Dhabi to create original Arabic content. And they're doing it because original content in the streaming wars for the likes of Netflix and the likes of Amazon and the likes of Apple is proving to be a winning ticket. Things like this.
8 seconds to you. Cue her.
Good morning. I'm bringing you some sad and upsetting news. And while I don't know the details of the allegations...
She's throwing me under the bus.
Mitch Kessler, my co-host and partner of 15 years, was fired today.
You!
And this...
I'm worried nobody threatens Hoffa. I got records, I got tapes. They're done.
I had to put you into this thing.
Sooner or later, everybody put here has a date when he's gonna go.
That was The Irishman, which is Netflix's new big original piece of content. Martin Scorsese directing, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino starring. Before that, you heard The Morning Show, which is Apple's offering, starring Brandy Scott.
Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon.
And winning this week... Golden Globes.
Golden Globes. So really interesting. If you look at the nominations for Golden Globes, The Morning Show's up for three. There are some headlines this morning saying, you know, historic nominations for Apple and a historic number of nominations. It's historic in the fact that they haven't had any before, I guess, could be the way of looking at that. But the interesting thing is there's going to be a load of movie stars at the Golden Globes who are there for television. George Clooney's up for some with Catch 22, which was a series that he has made from the novel. There's some question, though, about when we look at things like The Irishman, about how successful they actually are. The Irishman cost, do you want to take a guess at the price tag?
Oh, right. So Martin Scorsese, it's a movie, isn't it? Not a TV series.
It's a movie and it's a 210-minute movie.
So 3.5-hour movie. Right. And producer Shruti said it's not very good. She got bored and stopped watching after an hour. But Martin Scorsese directing, he's not cheap. Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci, the kind of Goodfellas crowd, getting the band back together, they're not cheap. Production values, they say $1 million an hour to create this kind of scripted content, but it's going to be much higher than that. I'm going to say... $35 million.
160.
Oh, my word.
And there's the question about how you measure the success of streaming content like this. I mean, movie box office, it's very easy. You've got box office takings. People have paid for movie tickets, for bottoms on seats. You know how many people have gone and you've got revenue back. Not so easy if you're a streaming service. So The Irishman and Netflix, the last I'd seen, hadn't released their own numbers, but Nielsen had released some numbers about it and saying, you know, there was every minute they reckon there was 13.2 million viewers and 17 million unique. And like many of these measurement things, there's a lot of ways of slicing that particular pie, as we know here in the world of radio. But here's what's interesting. Shruti was not alone in abandoning it. Only 18% of those 13 million accounts, because you also can't tell with streaming services how many people are watching. You can only tell that it's being watched. There might be five people on your sofa. There might be one person on your sofa. The cat might be on your sofa and you have gone off to make a cup of tea. Whereas with movies, obviously, you know how many tickets are out there. So out of those 13 million accounts, which is how it has to be looked at, only 18% finished the movie, or at least in one sitting, which was the same with Bird Box, the Sandra Bullock movie, held up as being the most successful launch ever, blah, 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 for the amount of accounts that watched it, but less than 20% actually finished it, because that's the other difference with movies. If you've paid to go and see a movie, you are likely to sit there, unless it is horrendous or offensive, or your kids are sick, you're likely to sit there to the end, aren't you? The few times I've left a movie early, it's been because who I was with has got upset at other customers' behaviour. Usually people on mobile phones, and it's been a bit like, we need to get out of here, I'm going to lose my rag, and we go. But you stay, whereas at home, it is very, very easy. Yeah, 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 should we watch something else? And you've got however many thousand other options on the same streaming service. So they're effectively providing their own competition to whatever you're watching.
And these are precisely some of the arguments that Mars Sheikh, who's the boss of Starzplay here in Dubai and across the region, the precisely the arguments that he gave for not creating original content. And he's been coming in here for a while. And Starzplay is up there with Netflix. They're kind of neck and neck in terms of who's got the biggest market share in streaming here in the Middle East, according to IHS crunches the numbers. They're about 30-ish percent each. And it moves and depends on how you crunch it in terms of revenue or users. But they're kind of neck and neck-ish. And he's always said, no, we're not going to produce original content because it's so expensive, $200,000 to $1 million an hour to produce scripted drama, and the returns just aren't there. And therefore, they have been aggregators of content. You and I are big fans of Billions, for example, US TV drama. Other people have their favourites. Vikings is popular and so on, and Arabic TV series and stuff coming out of Egypt and Turkey. But they've always bought it in. So when I saw yesterday that they've teamed up with Imagination in Abu Dhabi, the big production company, I thought, hang on a minute. This is quite a dramatic U-turn.
And it's a risky U-turn as well. I mean, Netflix's first foray into Arabic language programming, Jinn, attracted a lot of the attention it attracted was controversial attention.
It's true. Yes. I mean, as well as will people watch it or not, if you offend even a handful of people and suddenly on Twitter, that's not good for you, is it?
I have just learnt, interestingly, that Netflix breaks people down into three types of customer when it comes to them doing their own numbers. They have starters who just watch the first 2 minutes of everything, watchers who make it to about 70%, and completers who finish.
Which one are you?
I'm a watcher.
You're a watcher?
Yeah, because I get, particularly with series, I'll get through sort of, you know, 2/3 of the series and then something new's up there and I think, oh, hang on, new series of The Crown, and I slip over. And so there's a lot of stuff in my account that's never been finished.
But I'm all three. Because you snack and you look at things and it grabs you.
Did you say you snack?
Well, on television, you know. It's just what the kids, it's woke.
Snacking.
It's what the kids do when they consume content, they snack. And then you find something that you really like. And then, yeah, I still haven't finished, I forgot his name now, the Netflix one, House Cards. Haven't finished the final series. I haven't finished The Crown yet, season two, let alone season three. But... Yeah,
I got halfway through a Bikram documentary the other night
and
then realised.
Oh, that's really good.
No, yeah,
no,
but
I've
read the book.
Documentary's brilliant.
The book's better. There's a better book.
This is the scandal about Bikram Yogra, the man who founded it. That is amazing.
I felt the book had more of a narrative arch, but that's fine. Well, this is not a hill I'm willing to die on.
Let us know your thoughts. The question we're asking this morning on Twitter is, what does it take for you to actually put in your credit card details and sign up to one of these things? Because there are many of them around now, and frankly, there's too many for us all to have them. There's a 7 or 8 here in the Middle East.
You can't. You forget. I've signed up to stuff, paid for it, forgot it was even there. Which is, of course, what people want you to do with apps and all the rest of it. I have to go twice a year through my phone and get rid of the apps that I'm no longer paying for. Weight Watchers, I've been paying them for a year and eating what I want.
Yes, exactly. We in our household, we've been they're indoors. I said we've got to have a bit of a cull because we've got too many of these things.
Yeah.
It's probably right. I mean, they're all like, you know, $5 or $10 each. So you kind of think, you know, what's that? 50, it's the price of a cup of coffee a month.
Until you've got half a dozen of them and then all of a sudden it's not.
It's Dubai. So we're saying, what does it take for you to actually punch in your credit card details and sign up for one of these things? Is it A, original local content, or B, top international shows? And I'm clicking on top international shows because, if I'm honest, that's why I sign up, not for the local content. And I say that with a heavy heart because we are local content producers. I mean, that's how we earn our living. So we should be banging the drum of locally produced content. But honestly, if I'm honest, I sign up and I pay money to watch Premier League football. I sign up to watch House of Cards. I sign up to have a back catalogue of the Star Wars movies and so on.
I sign up to watch Mexican and Spanish movies and series in the hope that I will somehow absorb the language whilst I'm doing the dishes.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Starzplay, streaming TV service, teaming up with Imagination. They're going to produce original Arabic language local content. Joining us in the studio this morning is the CEO of Starzplay. Delighted to welcome Mars Sheikh. Now, nice to have you here, but last time you were here, I know Malcolm asked you about this. Are you going to produce original content like Netflix does? And you said, no, it's too expensive. We're going to stick with buying in content. So, what's changed?
So there's it has been a change since we last spoke. I think it's a combination of factors for us. One, we're now entering our fifth year as a service, and now we have over billions of minutes of content consumed on our platform and millions of customers having used our service. So we feel now is the time to learn from the data, learn from those insights, and based on those insights, produce an original Arabic show that'll cater to the youth in the region. That's perhaps number one. The second thing that it's becoming more and more obvious for us is that this segment of the market, the youth, the age group between 7 to 25, especially the Arab youth, has been, you know, we've not created content to target them specifically, and as an industry. And so this is our first step into addressing that segment of the market.
So specifically, you've teamed up with Imagination in Abu Dhabi, and you're going to produce it here in the UAE, rather than in, say, Egypt or some of the other powerhouse producers of Arabic language content.
That's correct. So one of the things we like about partnering with Imagination is they always say that their mission is not to create a company, but to create an industry. So to us, they're production house, and then we'll work with them to identify the right crew, the right cast, and the right talent to bring this show together. But yes, as a first step, being a local company in Dubai, we felt very strongly about working with Imagination.
Making telly isn't cheap. How much are you forecasting that this series will cost, and how does that financial relationship break down here between you and Imagination?
Sure. So this is one of the other difficult parts of our evolution, Brandy, right? There's been other companies that have done it a little too early, without proving their own business model, without having those insights into what to produce. And then, you know, there's the other side where you don't produce it and you lose that mass audience, you lose that mass market. So, and cost is obviously a key part of the consideration here. So the show and the production is entirely funded by Stars Play. So it's we are the ones funding the production. Where Imagination comes in is with their experience and skill set and that ability to do that storytelling and produce high quality content. We are hoping that working with them, we'll be able to do it in the most efficient way.
So what kind of price tag, what estimates? I mean, you'll have done the sums. Are you expecting this to cost?
Well, we're looking at over 3 to 4 million dirhams when the show is done and produced.
Per episode, or is it total production?
It's the total production.
What have you learned from other forays into this? Netflix, again with Imagination, a couple of years ago, launched Justice, which is a crime drama, an Emirati Arabic language crime drama. What have you learned from others in this industry who have experimented with this?
Sure. So, first of all, this is going to be very different from Justice. So Justice was on Abu Dhabi TV, then it was on OSN as well. So it was a show that Netflix licensed, not actually produced with Imagination. So our production is specifically meant for Stars Play platform. And with that, the reason I highlight that is we start with the premise that we're targeting the Arab youth between 17 to 24-year-old who are binge watchers and who are consuming content on digital platforms. So it's not meant to go on broadcasting and linear television. It's meant for the streaming audience.
But where Netflix has run into controversy with its Arabic language content is Djinn.
Right.
How do you make something that is modern and relevant to those younger watchers that you were talking about, but also do it without upsetting people?
Yeah, it's a very delicate balance, but this is where having been a service for last 5 years in the region, and that consumption of billions of minutes over the years gives us insights into what this audience will accept. So, for example, you know, we're still a culture that's steeped in traditions and family values, so we might accept certain, you know, scenes or certain types of dialogue in English language content, but we don't like it when it's done in Arabic. So we're sensitive to those cultural norms, but it's finding that delicate balance. But being a local company and working with Imagination is perhaps what gives us confidence that we can strike that balance.
How are you going to judge the success of this? We've been talking about The Irishman this right. morning. And the fact that figures suggest that whilst a huge amount of accounts have started watching it, less than 20% may have finished. Given that when someone shows something at home through a StarzPlay account, you can't tell if five people are watching, one person is watching, right. no one's watching, everyone's gone out to play a bit of backyard cricket. How do you actually judge what kind of audience you're getting?
So that's the perhaps the good part of our service is that when people are consuming our content, we get a fair amount of insights. So whether what device they're watching it on, whether they're watching it on their mobile phone or on their big screens, what time of the day they're watching on. So we get a fair amount of insights. And ultimately, you know, the measure for success is how many new subscribers we get and how long they stay with us. Does it increase our subscriber acquisition? And does it increase our retention and engagement with our audience?
Finally, Mars, what's next in terms of original content? This is for the, not even the millennials, the Gen Zers. Any plans to target millennials, even
Generation X?
Generation X is like the two people you're talking to at the moment.
Look, I think this is our first step, and it's a big milestone for us. But our plan is to have a cadence of 3 to 4 original shows a year, and that'll be in partnership with ImageNation as well as other producers in the region.
It's a great initiative. Best of luck with that. Thanks very much indeed for joining us today. Mars Sheikh is the co-founder and CEO of StarzPlay. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
Starting with Amin Nasser, who's the CEO of Aramco, because in about 3 hours' time, he's going to be doing this. Or something like it.
But with a very small hammer.
You've been looking at the bell in the Tadawul Stock Exchange in Riyadh, and it is?
It's absolutely gorgeous. It's a standalone swinging bell in an Arabic-style arch that sits on a table, and you get to hit it with a sort of a gongy hammer thing.
This is Amin Nasser, the CEO of Aramco.
I think we are proud of the listing of Aramco. It will increase our visibility internationally. We are a very strong company.
But what's going to happen when trading starts? We think actually 11 a.m. Dubai time. So that's about, what, 4.5 hours from now. Well, one of the people who's bought into it is Zachary Seferati, who's the CEO of the Dubai-based investment company Dalma Capital. And we've asked him what's going to happen once trading begins. And he thinks, given the overwhelming demand, particularly here in the Gulf, that the share price will probably jump.
We think that the trading environment on the first day will be very favorable, given that there is significant demand and not an obvious supply of shares on the first day of trading. As you can imagine, with institutions now 623% oversubscribed, a lot of institutional investors will find that the amount of shares that they will receive in Aramco are significantly below their target. And they will then need to buy shares after the listing in order to meet the target weight or target size of Aramco in their portfolios. Now, it's not obvious who they'll be buying shares from, because retail investors who made one-third of the offering are very disincentivized to sell their shares because of the bonus share scheme. Retail investors receive one share for every 10 that they hold, up to 100 shares in bonus shares, as long as they hold their shares for 180 uninterrupted days. This means that supply and demand conditions on the 11th, on the first day of trading, will be very favorable and very much on the bullish side. So we think that there's actually a decent probability that the market trades limit up. What that means is that that Aramco could be up 10% in the first day. The Tadawul limits the amount of pricing difference in any given day to plus or minus 10%. So trading limit up would mean that on the first day, Aramco would be up 10%. We can't rule that out as a possibility, given the huge amount of demand and no obvious supply for sellers of shares on the first day of trading.
Zachary Seferati of Dalma Capital here in Dubai talking about the Aramco IPO. Trading begins in just a few hours' time in Riyadh. Now, Brandy, your newsmakers this morning are with two newsmakers for the price of one, the 4-star hotel guest and the 5-star hotel guest.
Yep, my question for you this morning, what's the difference between 4-star hotel guests and their 5-star equivalents?
About 500 dirhams.
No. What they steal.
Okay.
We've got another one of those reports that we love so much on the Business Breakfast. What people nick from hotels.
And it's different depending on the star of hotel.
It's different depending on the star of the hotel. It's different depending on what nationality you are. Trigger warning, stereotypes to come.
Okay, fine.
Wellness Heaven has spoken to over 1,000 hoteliers to talk about what the most commonly stolen things are. Topping the lists, by the way, are towels, followed by bathrobes, followed by hangers. They found that different people take different stuff. Apparently, the German and the British guests are the most boring. They are most likely to nick the towels and the bathrobes.
That's the Brits.
Yep. Austrians are most likely to steal the dishes and the coffee machines.
Dishes? Coffee machines?
Oh, yeah. Coffee machine came in, it was in the top 15. It came in 14th alongside light bulbs. 7% of thefts were reported were light bulbs or coffee machines.
That's bold.
It is bold, but it's going to get better. Italians seem to prefer stemmed glassware.
Okay.
The French were the most spectacular. TV sets
and
the,
no.
and the remote controls. So also practical. The Dutch, however, the most practical, taking the light bulbs and the toilet paper. One thing they did see a huge difference between four-star and five-star theft was that the quality of the theft was higher in the five-star hotels. So artwork was five times more likely to be taken from a luxury hotel than a four-star. High-quality TV sets more likely to be taken from the five-star. I'm actually guessing, by the way, that it's because the artwork and the TV sets are just better in the high-end hotels. Mattresses more likely to be stolen from a five-star than a four-star. Eight times more likely.
Rewind. You just said mattresses.
I did.
How on earth do you nick a mattress?
Well, funnily enough, you don't take it out through reception. Most mattresses, according to the survey, that go missing from hotel rooms go missing A, in the middle of the night, and B, in hotels that have direct elevator access to an underground car park. So what you're actually doing is you're getting the mattress out your room, into the hall, into the elevator, and then straight down into the car without having to go through reception.
I'm aware that this is a risk of turning into a how-to guide, but that's quite smart.
It takes some planning and forethought, does it not? And also, that's not a one-person job. I couldn't wrangle a mattress out myself.
But we know that many of the hotel companies, I think you can buy the Westin bed, and you can buy a Ritz-Carlton bed. The whole kit and caboodle with the pillows and the mattress pad is $25,000 or more, isn't it? It's not a cheap thing.
No, and I mean, hotel beds are great. Hotel beds are better than yours by definition, particularly in the posh end. Having a look at the top 15 things to go missing, there's a lot of stuff that is a bit like, yeah. Blankets, pillows, what have you, cutlery, pens. That's not theft, taking
no.
a pen. They've also got cosmetics down here. Again, not theft. The shampoos are yours. You've paid for them.
Yeah.
You haven't, however, paid for the light bulbs, the hair dryers and all the rest of it. Why would you steal a hotel hairdryer? 8% of hoteliers say that they've seen it happen. The hairdryers are always lousy.
They're dreadful, aren't they?
Tablet computers, though, coming in with 12% was one that I thought, well, that's new. Because you're seeing more and more hotels, aren't you, having tablets in the hotel rooms, tablets that can draw the curtains or audio your room service or whatever it happens to be, and people are nicking them.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go. Take a look at the 5 and 10.
And as we head into the festive season, we are talking luxury retail now with Guy Cheston, Partnerships Director at Harrods. Guy, it's lovely to have you in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Brandy. It's great to be here.
We've heard a lot about the issues faced by luxury retailers and by department stores in general through the year. What kind of year has 2019 been for Harrods?
Well, despite the geopolitical tensions around the world and threat of China-US trade wars and the slowdown in China, we've actually had a tremendous year. 2019's proved to be a very strong year again. But that's not withstanding some great challenges ahead, I think, for the luxury sector.
Tell me about those challenges. I mean, what are you guys, when you're sitting in your meetings, what's on the table?
Well, there's couple of key issues, really. One is the way that the luxury consumer is changing. Consumers, particularly the millennial consumers, are looking for more experiences than perhaps products. Despite this, it's still the big super brands that are driving retail sales, certainly for us. But in saying that, it's also consumers looking for perhaps explaining about how they prefer to. It's not so much about what they have; it's how they like to behave and what they stand for has become more and more important to them. So they're looking for something special. They're looking for unique experiences, and they're willing to pay a premium for that.
Now, you at Harrods obviously sell stuff, but you are also something of a London institution. Does that make it easier or harder for you to sell experiences, particularly to younger customers?
Well, I think we're a global institution. We're in fact London's third biggest tourist destination with 40,000 footfall every single day. I think what Harrods has always stood for is that it's a really different and unique and magical place. Harrods is all about making extraordinary memories and delivering something which is really different to what you find anywhere else on the high street and in saying that, anywhere else around the world. So I think for us, it's around creating, innovating. It's about using our history and our heritage, but also staying ahead of the game and giving today's customer what they're looking for.
You mentioned international visitors there. How important is the Gulf customer to you?
The Gulf customer is our second biggest international customer base behind China. We attract just under 60,000 customers a year from the Middle East region. And they spend significantly in the store, particularly over those peak summer months. And we've attracted quite a lot of business investment over the past few years, with particularly in the property sector, where we've had companies such as Emaar, Damac, Omniat, who've used Harrods as a showcase to market luxury property developments in the region to the Harrods customer in London.
Who walks into a department store, maybe to go through the food hall, maybe to buy yourself an outfit, and walks out with a two-bedroom flat?
Well, you'd be surprised. There's this great story of a lady that came in to buy a pair of tights and she walked out with buying a £10 million property. So it does happen. I think, again, Harrods is the place where you don't just pop in and out. You spend time there. The average dwell time in the store is over 2.5 hours. So people come. It's actually a lifestyle choice in terms of spending a day there, eating in one of our 29 restaurants. It's covering 335 departments. There's 1 million square feet of selling space. So it really is a day out. It's quite an experience. So there is time to browse and to look at different things that are being promoted in store.
And yet you also have a very strong e-commerce presence. What percentage of your sales, what chunk of your business is coming online now rather through the actual physical shop?
Well, it's still just under 10% of our overall sales, our online sales, but it is growing by 30-40% year on year for the last 3 or 4 years. So it clearly is the future. It's interesting to see that how luxury brands have been actually quite slow to take up online marketing. But I think today almost every single luxury brand is now selling online. And clearly that is going to be an important channel for the future. And for us, I think what we've seen is a big difference in the way that we've had to become content creators. So we are creating digital content that then plays out across social media, particularly Instagram, to appeal to this millennial customer. And that's a way of obviously attracting and pulling customers into the physical bricks and mortar store.
Let's talk about your visit out here to the UAE at the moment. You're the partnerships director, and you mentioned a few of the property brands there that have partnered with Harrods to market to your customers. What other kinds of companies are you speaking to while you're here? Where are those partnerships going?
Well, we work with our agency over here, the Media Vantage, who we've been working with for the past 5 years. We started distributing a magazine, the Harrods magazine, which we have done for many years, but we publish an Arabia edition, which we launched a couple of years ago. So that's an important communication tool for us to really keep in touch with our Middle Eastern-based customers. But also to, I guess, just to keep Harrods front of mind in the region, because it is such an important region for us in terms of international customers. And it's making them feel, you know, that they're belonging to Harrods, because I think today so much about engaging with luxury is that sense of belonging to a club, to a brand, where you've got that brand affinity. So we feel by having that touch point of the magazine over here, that's really, really important. So, you know, we're open and keen to talk to companies based over here who are looking to reach the Harrods customer and that alignment with Harrods the brand.
Could we see a physical Harrods here? I mean, we have a number of international luxury department stores.
I think it's unlikely for the time being. There is only one Harrods, as we say, and it's almost like the mountain coming to Mohammed, in the sense of, you know, we're a global icon, and we attract people from all over the world that comes to Harrods in London, and really that's where the focus is.
What about an in-store, an in-airport store, Harrods?
We have airport stores around the world, and that could be a possibility in the future.
Could be. Have you had any chance with Dubai Airports about it?
Not that I'm aware of.
Thanks very much for joining us. Guy Cheston is the Partnership Director at Harrods. We appreciate you coming into the studio.
Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back tomorrow morning live on air at 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.